of the Prism series, and we wouldn't have gotten back from the Prism series yesterday had it not been for you. I mean, that is the reality of you contributing to keep the horn going. And I am so proud, and we accomplished, and what, and you know, Ferg did a man's work for 3 weeks. We were up at 5 o'clock every morning, and we were in bed at 11. And that all, and it was work from that period, from 5 to 11. He did a man's work. And I'm very proud of our horn intern junior grade. We may have to take the junior grade off after these 3 weeks. But thanks to you all, and have a wonderful weekend. Rick Smith is next. Without Rick Smith, I think people like William and others will tell you that at least get his podcast if you can't listen live. If you can listen live, listen live. But if you can't, get the podcast, because he is worth it. I don't say enough about Rick. He is an amazing, amazing talent. Thanks to Lottie in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy, who wrote a wonderful little post about, hey, is Bob ever coming back home? I love that. Thanks to our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy, at headonradionetwork.com.
Then democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk to Pennsylvania State Representative Eugene DePasquale about the budget, who it's hurting, how it's going to all play out, and if we can get the Democrats to get out in the streets and say, look, this is a moral document. This is what the party of family values has done to the state of Pennsylvania, and this is who it's going to hurt. Get out in the streets. Get out with the people and push this. This is an opportunity, folks, to show what their true values are. You know, while they're speaking through their lips, their actions speak much louder. And I'm hoping that folks are paying attention to that. We're going to talk to the good representative about that in the second hour. Fred McLucky, legislative director at the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, going to be here talking about the cross-border trucking issue. Again, it's open, I guess. The agreement has been signed. And the one thing that I take from this whole situation, the power of tariffs, something that a lesson maybe we need to learn, maybe a lesson that we need to start talking about with the Chinese when you look at the massive trade deficit that we have with them. Maybe a little carrot and stick might not be a bad thing. Look how well it worked against us. The Mexicans smart. Smart policy. They said, well, we're going to put massive tariffs on 92 of your most strategically placed goods. They know who the power brokers in this nation are, the agricultural people, and they squeezed them a little bit, just a little bit, just a little. And look what happened. We now have a southern border that is going to be open to Mexican domiciled trucks all over the country. Congratulations. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Judy Conte, Federal Advocacy Coordinator with the National Employment Law Project. There was a hearing on the Fair Labor Standards Act. I love the mentality businesses seem to be taking now, because, you know, heaven forbid we use the labor laws and all of the laws of the land as they were intended, which is to protect workers and to put a floor underneath people's feet. No. Instead of wage theft, the business community is saying, well, no, it's not that we broke the law. No, it's that the laws are broken. They're not working the way we want them to, so we should rewrite those. So there'll be an interesting conversation with Judy Conte about that. And in the third hour, Bo Hadai, he's going to be here talking about his piece, Publicopoly Exposed, How ALEC, the Koch brothers and their corporate allies plan to privatize government. And then this ALEC group kind of flies under the radar. Very well funded. Another one of these right-wing groups, very well funded by the Koch brothers and the billionaire class, to push their agenda, to lobby for their loopholes, to lobby for their subsidies, for their welfare, at the expense of you. We're in this mess because folks like this got their way. When they deregulated the financial markets, They said, okay, Banks, go ahead. Go ahead, Banks. You can be gambling houses. You can be a casino. Go ahead. You're not going to just be a boring old investment bank where you go and put your savings account and take out a loan every now and again. Safe and boring. No, we're gonna let you put a roulette wheel in. We're going to roll the dice. Yeah. Because we didn't learn from the Great Depression. Have we learned? Evidently not, because if you look at what's going on in Congress right now, they're doing everything they can do to make sure that we don't go and re-regulate, because we haven't. It's amazing, amazing stuff. Some interesting polling numbers out today by a wide margin. They say that the majority of people in this country are blaming former President George W. Bush for the economy. And, yeah, duh. This is his baby. This started in September of 2008. We were falling off the cliff. Had it not been for this president, we would have continued to fall. And the Pat Toomeys of the world wanted a much harder down. They wanted us to fall further. Now, am I thrilled with everything that's going on? Absolutely not. But the one thing I'll say about this president is right at the beginning, he did what he had to do to make sure that people like you and me didn't suffer too much, that we didn't have that hard down that the Pat Toomeys and the Republicans wanted, that collapse, that absolute crash to the hard bottom. And now he's getting beat up for it. Now, me personally, I would not have extended unemployment as far as he did. I would have created a jobs program. I would have done everything I could possibly do not to extend the unemployment. Because, look, while there still may be 9-10% unemployment, that means 90% of the people who are employed, unless you're using other numbers, and it's like 85%, but still the vast majority are employed. And you don't want to have people sitting around being viewed the way the Republicans have spun the message, how they framed it. Well, they're lazy. They don't want to go get jobs. They're not like you. They're not going out there getting jobs like you. And what corporate America's done, and this is just, it's amazing how they've gotten away with this. They've used the unemployment situation to make you work harder, take less. And you look at JP Morgan's, what was it? It was their July edition of their Eyes on the Market report. And right in their magazine, it says that their profit margin increases. It increased by 1.3% from 2000 to 2007, with profits margins not seen in decades. This latest one, not seen in decades, 88% growth income, 88% growth. And you know what they conclude? They conclude that the reduction in wages and benefits explain the majority of net improvement in margins. So that means that they stole from you and they put it in their pockets. So from 2000 to 2007, they saw profit margins increase by about 1.3%. Since 2009, they have seen 88% in income growth. And only 1% of that has gone to wages. So that massive amount of money that they have taken, they took from you. They took from me. They took from every working person in this country. And now they're telling us, well, gee, you know, you can't raise taxes on us. You can't put fees on us. Oh, gee, you can't regulate us. And I'm going, well, exactly what can we do? Well, I guess the idea is we can continue what we've been doing, giving them everything they could ever possibly want. Huge subsidies, huge handouts, you know, whatever you want, deregulation, whatever you want. You know, fracture an occasional labor law, turn the cheek the other way. Yeah, it's only workers, don't worry about it. You look at the thing with Boeing. Yeah, don't worry about it. They built a $1 billion facility in South Carolina. What are you going to do? Make Boeing close it? Yeah, if they violated the law, sure. You know, if I broke the law, don't you think they would come after me and make me, make the offended party whole? You bet your behind they would. And you look at this debt thing, this whole debt ceiling thing. The Republicans have fabricated another crisis. They're the ones pushing this down the road, and I think the American people are coming around to it. A new poll out has found that more Americans trust the president over the Republicans. Yeah, 45% favor Obama and his approach to trimming the national debt. And, you know, 48% blame Congress. So, you know, you look at this and you go, well, they did it. And what I find amazing is I'm still talking to a couple of people who, well, you know, we need to cut, because there's lazy people. So I got one of these emails, and I've been, you know, asking myself, what's the Republican plan? If you remember, they came out with the big pledge. There was the big pledge, and it was all about jobs. All about jobs. And you haven't heard anything about the pledge lately, have you? Anybody heard any other Republicans talking about the pledge? I remember up until the election, it's all they could talk about. You know, their 48-page document with 27 pages of smiling white people and a whole bunch of flowery language talking about jobs, because that's 1, 2, and 3. But since November, nothing about the pledge, nothing about jobs, nothing. So basically telling you they have no idea, they have no plan. But I got one of these emails today, and it's not unlike many of the Lulu emails I get. But the difference here is this one was accurate. The rest of them are full of a bunch of, you know, half-truths, lies, you know, misrepresentations, or just plain made-up stuff or misattributed. This was actually spot on. It was titled Texas to the White House. And it says back on May 23rd, the Texas governor, Rick Perry, he gave a speech. And they go through part of the speech. And, you know, basically, the speech was to whip up support for this thing called the response. Sometime in August, you know, they're going to have their anti-gay love fest. They're going to have what they're saying, quote, is a solemn gathering of prayer and fasting for our country. Kind of like our mayor did here, kind of like the mayor of Harrisburg did here recently, had their little fasting, didn't help much, but, you know, they had it, so good for them. And, you know, he goes off, and let me just read some of the speech that he goes off into. He says, I tell people that personal property and the ownership of that personal property is crucial to our way of life. Our founding fathers understood that it was a very important part of the pursuit of happiness. Being able to own things that are your own is one of the things that makes America unique. Kind of like owning people, if you remember. But he says, I happen to think it's in jeopardy. It's in jeopardy because of taxes. It's in jeopardy because of regulation. It's in jeopardy because of a legal system run amok. And I think it's time for us to just hand it over to God and say, God, you're going to have to fix this. This is the governor of Texas. He says, I think it's time. I think it's time for us to use our wisdom and our influence to really put it in God's hand. And that's what I'm going to do. And I hope you'll join me. So now here's a guy, he's the governor of Texas, saying, you know, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to hope that God does it for me. Now, understand, you know, Perry, he likens himself to the prophet. He wants to be a prophet of God, and he said that a number of times. What I find amazing is how quickly he can combine his religion with extreme right-wing anti-government ideology that really has nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus at all. But I find it amazing that people will consider voting for this guy, even though he is telling you. He's telling you he's not going to do anything. He's going to sit and pray. So while cities are flooding, they'll sit and pray. While people are starving, they'll sit and pray. While children don't get health care, while granny's not getting health care, while we're seeing all of the problems that this country has, he's not going to do anything. This is what he's telling you. We're just going to put it in the hands of God. And look, I have my faith like most people have, and there's a time and place for that, but I think on some level, maybe I'm wrong. But I do believe we are our brother's keeper, and I do believe we should all be chipping in and doing the work of the community, doing the work of we the people, instead of sitting back and hoping and praying that something will fix itself. It's kind of like their vision on the economy. There's going to be an invisible man with an invisible hand. He's going to guide the economy invisibly. So we don't have to do anything. And what that really does a nice job of doing is it takes all responsibility away from the people who are doing nothing. And that that is what we're going to get. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, State Representative Eugene D. Pasquale, stick around. We're right back after this. Boy, that's horrible. But it is summer, and that means camping for many. Kids, come on, kids, here's your cabin, here's your mess hall, there are the boats on the waterfront, baseball fields over there, and don't forget the local natural gas drilling well. And just like Mexico, don't drink the water. It seems that 4 summer camps here in the state of Pennsylvania have signed leases with the drilling companies, which could allow the deep bore drilling technique at campgrounds by this fall. Kind of goes hand in hand with our governor's flip comment to put gas wells on school campuses, you know, to fill the massive budget holes that he blew in their budgets. You gotta really, really wonder. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I've got State Representative Eugene D. Pasquale on the line. State Representative, thanks for taking time for us.
So, Rick, how's it going?
It's good. What do you think about, you know, I see the Republicans cut the Department of EPA, the Department of Environmental Protection. Why don't we just put these campers in charge of policing and overseeing the drilling activities in the state? What do you think?
It makes no sense if you're thinking rationally, but if you're not thinking rationally, it makes complete sense. Here's their irrational thought that they try to paint as mainstream. They say they care about the environment. They say that they're going to enforce vigorous regulations of the drillers, and then they cut the very people that are inspecting the drillers. It really, when you think about it, I think paints a picture of an administration that is not committed to protecting the environment.
Well, I mean, we've fallen down the rabbit hole. They're telling us up is down and front is back. Don't worry about it. They'll police themselves. And I'm going to go, look how well Wall Street did.
And by the way, I say this, that even if you take that argument and consider it true that they will do the best they can, still, you need to have independent eyes watching that. Because any business, and look, I say this is, it's not that even necessarily evil, look, their idea is to make a profit.
Absolutely.
And if it's a tough cycle and they're looking to, they got to squeeze a couple extra profits, they're going to be making pullbacks in places that don't necessarily generate them revenue. That's just the nature of the capitalist system. So that's why you have a Department of Environmental Protection there to be the independent watcher of that, to make sure that that drive for profit, which every business is, going to try to do, doesn't happen at the expense of the environment, which would only sacrifice the future of Pennsylvania.
And really, you're not going to harm the corporations who are doing the right thing. You don't want a bad actor out there cutting corners and causing everybody else to follow him down the drain.
Good businesses want a vigorous environmental protection department, because if they're doing the right thing and their competitors aren't, they are, in a sense, going to appear to be losing out because they will be making less profit because of doing the right thing. Having a strong, tough environmental protection agency makes sure that the playing field is level.
Absolutely. I've been railing on this budget because I just think this is immoral.
It may be literally the worst budget in the last 5 decades in Pennsylvania.
I absolutely agree, but it shows the whole priorities of this administration and the Republican Party. And what I've been saying is Democrats didn't have any voice in this. So this is all the Republicans. This is their vision. This is their vision for the state. This is their morality, their values, all balled up into one.
Two things. Number one, it's clear that, other than the vote at the end, the Democratic Party had no say in this budget. Also, you can fairly say that the public elected the Republicans, and so they had the right to govern with that electoral success. But now we see what that electoral success has brought. Disinvestment in the future of Pennsylvania by cutting education with nearly a $1 billion surplus there. Cutting environmental protection, which, again, shortchanging the future, while at the same time not putting a reasonable severance tax on Marcellus Shale drilling, which every other state, including Texas, Oklahoma, Wyoming, has, and giving corporate tax breaks to companies that are not investing in Pennsylvania. I could at least understand if you were giving a corporate tax break and getting some jobs in return for that, but the corporate tax breaks that corporate passed through without legislative approval didn't even come with the promise of jobs with them. So we lost on several fronts in this budget.
So what I'm saying is what has to happen, and I think Democrats have to take the bull by the horn and take the people, take this to the people in the streets and say, look, this is the party of family values. This is the party who's told you about their morality and their moral fiber. This is what they chose to do, and I think Democrats have to make the moral case. They've got to go to the streets, go to the people and say, this is what it is.
We are having policy hearings all over the state, but you're right. This needs to be a continued nonstop effort for the next 18 months. And to say, look, I've said this to even some teachers that admitted in the York area that they voted for Governor Corbett. I said, look, I know what the ad said. You could cut some state cars and get rid of, quote unquote, waste, fraud, and abuse at the Department of Public Welfare that turned out to be, breast cancer screenings and stuff like, I guess that in the Republican legislative mindset and for Governor Corbett is waste, fraud, and abuse. But what I'm telling people is, I know what the ad said. There was some ways you could tweak this, you could tweak that, and you could get a balanced budget with no taxes and not harm education. Well, we see what happened now. By not taxing the drillers, you're potentially damaging the environment and literally not investing money that is in the state treasury, close to $1 billion. We are shortchanging the future of Pennsylvania, not just for our kids and their ability for success, but also for the future of economy for Pennsylvania, because we need to have a trained workforce for the future.
Yeah, come on, Representative, you can tell me. There's that office there, that office of waste, fraud, and abuse with the gold-plated door and the hole with the fire pit in the middle of the room that just burns our tax dollars. You know it's there.
I will tell you, I've gone through the budget line by line, and I will promise you this. Not only if I find it, will I propose eliminating to it, but I will recommend strongly to the Democratic candidate for governor in 2014, they should make that part of their platform. I mean, it's ridiculous, the idea that you'd have $2 billion sitting around and no legislator would want to cut it.
No.
No governor would want to cut it. It's ridiculous.
It's odd, though, that you talk about the surplus that has come in. Anytime you make out a budget and it comes out better than you planned, you can make some of the cuts less. It's odd to me that, several years back when there was a rainy day fund, before the economy completely tanked, that the Republicans wanted to just hand that money out. But now that we're in the worst, we're still in the midst of the worst crisis in many of our lifetimes, they want to have a rainy day fund and not put the money back into the state. Seems kind of odd to me.
A couple things. It's actually worse than that. But let me start off with, if you look at the jobs picture nationally, it is not good. But the reason why it is bad as opposed to just mediocre is because of all the public sector job cuts.
Right.
If you look at it nationally, there is actually not great, but there has been continued solid private sector job growth. Again, we need it to be much better, but it is there. The reason why the unemployment rate continues to tick up is because of the governors like Kasich, Corbett, et cetera, across the country, Walker in Wisconsin, Scott in Florida, cutting all these public sector jobs, because that is having a drag on the economy. And so that's A. B, you talked about the rainy day fund. They actually didn't even put it in the rainy day fund. They did nothing with it. It's just sitting there. I mean, and I keep hearing from the governor, we have these long-term obligations like pension, et cetera. I'd love for the governor to say, okay, I disagree with Eugene on this about putting it into education, but here's my plan for doing it. I'm going to take a quarter and shore up the pension fund. I'm going to take a quarter and shore up our unemployment compensation fund. I mean, at least he would have a plan with the money.
Right.
There is literally no plan with that close to $1 billion surplus, and that's what I find. Look, I accept that there may be people that have a different point of view than me on how to invest that money. I recognize that. That's why you have, multiple legislators and one governor. But to literally not do anything with that money is unconscionable.
I absolutely agree. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Representative Eugene D. Pasquale. I look at some of the things going on in the Department of Welfare, and everybody likes to look at, and I think the name of it is misleading to start with, because the word welfare has been so badly demonized that, when you hear welfare, you think, oh, there's that welfare queen driving around in her Cadillac eating steak and all of that. But the reality is we're talking about programs that help a wide range of folks, the disabled, seniors, all kind of stuff. And I look at they've really given this department an awful lot of power to really make people's lives miserable.
Well, first of all, 70% of the quote-unquote welfare budget is medical assistance to the poor and disabled. So, if somebody wants to say they want to actually kick poor people, poor seniors out of nursing homes and take away wheelchairs from people. If they are actually for that, please admit that publicly, because that's 70% of the Department of Public Welfare budget. That's number one. Number two, this welfare code that passed literally gives an unelected bureaucrat unchecked power to make cuts to non-federally mandated programs in the Department of Public Welfare. And when I say that, understand, we have a legislature and a governor, and people can agree with decisions the legislature makes and disagree, but you have the ability to hold the governor and the legislature accountable at the ballot. And I'm not here to say we're perfect. There's times that I, you know, would do things differently when we were in the majority, et cetera. But you can hold us accountable at the ballot box. The Secretary of Public Welfare cannot be held accountable other than the governor potentially firing him. And it is literally the biggest delegation of legislative power, I think, in Pennsylvania history.
But isn't that almost unconstitutional somehow? I mean, because isn't the power of the purse in the legislature?
We did a motion on constitutionality, which obviously got voted down on party lines. But I agree. I don't believe the legislature can literally delegate that much. I don't think it's right. I'm stunned that legislators went along with that. I find it amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically abdicating your responsibility and giving up your job to somebody else. I mean, even if this were a Democrat doing this, I would be against it.
No. This is one. You're right. And I would hope that if I would ever give a future Democratic governor this type of authority for his cabinet secretary, you should be calling me on the carpet for that. This point is not about party. It's about giving an unelected bureaucrat who voters cannot hold accountable this type of power. I think what is really at play here is, though, is that these cuts are going to be very unpopular. And the legislative leaders did not want their members to put up votes for this. So that's why this happened. That's my opinion.
No, it's probably right on, because, you know, nobody wants to, if you look at this budget, you know, back in January, I predicted just about every cut that happened, because these are folks who weren't going to vote for Republicans anyway, the poor, the disabled, children, you know, look what they've done to the education budget.
But if these cuts were popular, I guarantee you this, look, I've been around politics a little bit, if these cuts that are going to be made to the Department of Public Welfare will be popular, members would want to vote on it so they could take credit for making the cuts.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, no matter what it is, what you guys do is, hey, look at me, it's a popularity contest.
Yeah, I mean, so if it was really something that they thought they could sell to the public, they'd be itching to put the bill up. The fact that that did not happen shows that internally they knew that these cuts were bad politically, and you could even make the argument moral, some of the stuff that's going to end up happening, but because of their own ideology, they gave the cabinet secretary the ability to do it without legislative approval.
Now, like the one woman I met over at the Capitol who was in a wheelchair and in really kind of bad shape, she said, look, if they're going to kill me, if I'm going to die over this, I'm going to do it in public where people see me.
Well, I mean, people need to come out of the shadows. The people that are going to be hurt, and maybe some have already been, especially some of the teacher, you have around 113 teacher layoffs in New York City, just New York City alone, not New York County, but New York City. They need to tell their story. Because sometimes people get the $27.3 billion or $28 billion or $26.9 billion budget passes on time. And whether it's 26.9 or 28.1 or anything in between, that's a big number.
Yes.
And it's faceless and it's just, seems big. We need to humanize what's actually happening.
And that's why I say you guys got to take to the streets and make the moral case that this was really, in my opinion, immoral.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
Last question I've got for you. You know, I'm looking at the prioritization of education in this state, and it's kind of like I'm kind of comparing it to transportation, to our infrastructure. For 30 years, we failed to invest adequately in infrastructure, and look what's happened. We got roads that are got potholes. We got bridges falling down. I fear we're doing the same thing to education.
It is almost like anything else in life. You get what you pay for. You get what you pay for. So if you're not going to invest properly in education, and then, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, you say, how come we're not stellar? Well, guess what? The same thing goes for our roads and bridges. And I even just saw, I think the recommendations are coming to the governor. I received a phone call from the press about it from the Transportation Advisory Commission that there's no expected new revenue. They think that they can get $2.5 billion just from savings in the Department of Transportation. It's literally stunning to think that they believe by not having emission stickers and by not having driver's license renewal centers that's going to fix the road funding problem.
What have we done? What have we done? Amazing stuff. Representative, I appreciate your time. Please keep up the fight. Keep up the good work. And you got to take this to the street, brother.
Absolutely, Rick. And thanks for having me on. And let's keep fighting ahead.
All right. Look forward to having you back again. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast right there. If you got something on your mind, question, comment, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, do you think you could do better with the budget? There is a website. It is budgethero.org. Going to give you the opportunity. This is the second version. This is Budget Hero 2.0. Going to give you the opportunity to balance the budget. Can you do a better job than they're doing in Washington? Can you do a better job than President Obama or John Boehner or the, you know, that little lunch money victim, Paul Ryan? Can you do better than them? Can you figure out how to balance the budget, balance the money coming in and the money going up with health care and with extending the Bush handouts, maybe ending the foreign aid? Kind of a great tool. And what it does is it shows you pretty much how difficult it would be to do this with cuts alone. In fact, it's impossible to do via cuts alone, which I kind of think is kind of the point here. The reality is for so long, we have been allowing the very wealthy in this country to walk away with trillions and trillions of dollars without us saying we could use some of that. And I look at the quote of the day. It comes from Monica Berlin. In her piece, All Work and No Pay, The Great Speed Up, she writes, for 90% of American workers, incomes have stagnated or fallen for the past 3 decades, why they've ballooned at the top and exploded at the very tippy top. By 2008, she writes, the wealthiest 0.1% of Americans were making 6.4 times as much as they did in 1980. In other words, all that extra work you've been taking on, the late nights, skipping lunch hours, the missed soccer games, paid off for them. And you go down the line and you go, look at all of this. Like I said earlier, the J.P. Morgan thing, 88% since 2009, 88% of income growth has gone to corporate profits. 1% has gone to wages. And J.P. Morgan comes out and says, look, why? Well, reduction in wages, reduction in benefits. That's what made the margins better. We were able to steal back that money. We're able to steal back that those gains that those workers got. I mean, doesn't that infuriate you at some point? And you look at these budgets. I got to be honest. For me, they're moral documents. They tell me, you know, you can preach to me all day long. You can tell me I'm a family values kind of guy. Show me. You know, I remember I worked for a guy one time. He said he believes in family values and he's a family man. Turns out, he meant his family. He could give a rat's behind about mine or any of the people I worked with because he worked the people like dogs. On weekends, late nights, overtime all the time. Didn't care about your family. So when you start looking at these budgets and you start listening to the rhetoric of the people who are ramming them down our throats, they talk about moral values. They talk about family values. Christian nation. I got to be honest, this budget is anything but Christian. And what I love I love that whole frame, and they've done a masterful job because we've all bought into it. This welfare queen, the mythical welfare queen, she's out there. She's driving around in her big caddy. She's eating the best prime rib, drinking the best Dom Perignon. And what we then do is we take that and we start to dehumanize everybody who collects welfare. Well, they're just lazy, or they're cheating the system. So when you have a Department of Public Welfare, people, all they hear is welfare. And as DePasquale said, 70% of the budget goes to helping poor people with health care. The woman that we met over there said, look, they take my health care away, I could die. So what does that say about us? What does it say about how we've allowed this to transpire without really standing up and having our voices heard? I mean, is it our priority to cheat the next generation of children out of the opportunity that we had so that we could save a couple of pennies? Is that our priority? I sure hope not. Because in the long run, and I think infrastructure is the perfect place to look, because that is the perfect analogy. For 30 years, we have been starving that portion of our nation. We've been starving the investment into roads and bridges. We've been starving the investment into rail lines and airlines and water quality. We've been starving the investment into our nation's valuable resource that generations before us invested heavily in. And look where we are now. We're trillions of dollars in the hole. I think it was $2.5 trillion we're going to need over the next 5 years just to not be horrible, just to be mediocre. Where'd that money go? We used to invest in it. We used to do it. Well, it went to the very, very wealthy. And that's a major problem, Jake. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point I hope folks wake up and I hope the Democrats take this to the street and I hope they make this the moral case that it has to be made. Say, these are the people who are being harmed.
I think in the end, Rick, those who are really being harmed and the interest groups that represent them, they're going to have to hit the street. They're going to have to force the Republicans to rethink, and that's not going to be easy, to rethink their position. That's not going to be easy. I think the only way to defeat this kind of thing is just simply to vote them out. And that's why it's so, so, so important. It's not only next year the President of the United States, is are we going to turn around some of these states that are completely controlled, not necessarily by the Republicans, although they are Republicans, they're controlled by the ultra-right. And we need to take, literally in each state, we need to take our country back.
So this afternoon, today in Dallas, and you got to love this, today in Dallas there was a stampede. Here's what they were doing. The state of Texas has not, they haven't done the Section 8 housing thing in a long time. So Dallas County Health and Human Services started taking applications for the federal Section 8 program. They haven't done it in 2 years, first time. So now they, in Dallas, they set up an opportunity at the Jesse Owens Memorial Complex. And some 15,000 people showed up. Huge crowd gathered at 5:30 a.m. So much for lazy, so much for sleep till noon. They were there at 5:30 to sign up for these programs. Why? Because they need homes. They need a place to stay. They want to get out of the projects and the slums. And I'm a fan of Section 8 housing. Some people are not. I think it's a great opportunity for people to be able to move up and get into better neighborhoods, better school districts, and learn a set of values, set of skills, that are going to help them move forward. I think it's a great program, and I can make the case that we're already. And I mentioned this a while ago, and I had this conversation about Section 8 housing with someone not too long ago. And they were saying, well, why should we have to pay to subsidize for these people to live in these houses that, we work hard for? And I said, the guy who lives in that multi-million-dollar mansion over there? The people who live in those, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 homes? You don't think we subsidize them? You don't think you and me, the working people of this this country subsidize their mortgages by allowing them to deduct that massive mortgage? And they've got the money to pay the house off. They've just chosen not to. In fact, you know, when I was going to pay my house off, and when I did, you know, the financial advisor said, no, you can invest that. Keep the mortgage. Mark that off. You invest it. No, pay the house off. So, you know, when I look at a helping hand up, I don't have a problem with it. When I look ahead of me and I see the guy who's doing really well, and I'm still subsidizing him, I got a problem with that. And that's the way we need to start looking at things in this country. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. When we come back, Rupert Murdoch in the news. Back after this. Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So the AP's reporting, law enforcement officials say that the FBI has opened up an investigation into the allegations that media mogul Rupert Murdoch's News Corp sought to hack the phones of the September 11th victims. And you sit back and you go, I hope if they did, we find them and you lock them up for a very long time. I mean, because if you remember that, and I go back to that time where it really, really ticked me off that some people are scumbags. I mean, some people are really just rotten, no good for nothing, low down snakes in the grass. You remember those, every time you turned around, there was a new charity coming up, and sometimes they were scams. People ripping off the system, going, oh, yeah, I can make some money for myself after exploiting these people's losses. And it's just ridiculous, and I hope they do investigate it. And if there is any of this going on, I hope they find them, and I hope they lock them up. And you look at today, Earl Blumenauer, Democrat from Oregon, he wrote a letter calling for an investigation in News Corp saying, quote, I'm deeply concerned that the breadth of the alleged crimes and the seeming indifference to illegal activities at News of the World may be indicative of a pattern of corruption at News Corporation. The pace at which this wide-ranging scandal is unfolding suggests that we may have only scratched the surface of potential illegal practices by this company. And I'm going, you know, if one of them do it, you never know. And it'll be interesting to see where this goes. The Borowitz Report, you know, kind of talking about this as well. He writes, in a blow that many insiders saw as the last straw for embattled media titan Rupert Murdoch, Satan today returned Mr. Murdoch's soul to him and demanded his money back. Rupert Murdoch has done my bidding for decades, but that relationship is now terminated, read the terse statement from the Prince of Darkness, whose close associates said he'd been disgusted by Murdoch's recent activities. Purchased by Satan in Melbourne, Australia in 1951, Murdoch's soul is estimated to have a current value of $9. Around the media world, observers were stunned by the latest setback for Mr. Murdoch, who in Satan is losing one of his closest and most powerful allies. But according to Ian Langstrom, who at his post at the University of Nottingham has studied Mr. Murdoch's relationship with Satan for years, the slap in the face from the Lord of Misrule should not come as a surprise, he says. Satan never wants to be the last one to desert a sinking ship. He always wants to take the lead from British politicians. In what many saw as tacit admission of the depth of his current problem, Mr. Murdoch totally canceled plans to purchase the remainder of the British government that he does not already own. Elsewhere, Roger Clemens celebrated his steroid case by declaring a mistrial by throwing a car across the courthouse parking lot. How interesting. And, you know, you look at this situation with Murdoch. And I don't know if you've seen this, though, Jake. Even with all of the allegations that are going on, his company is still in the process of financing a $27 million no-bid contract with the state of New York because there's some education money out there, And Murdoch has come out and said, look, you know, I know it's going to be the case. It's a lot of money, a lot of money in education, and we're going to go after it.
Well, I think he's in trouble for other things, too. I think he has some serious charges. I just saw an interview tonight with Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat that's been there for a long time from California, who's on an important committee, and according to her, they're investigating whether he violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. He's also accused of bribing officials, wiretapping charges. He's had his way, as we know, in this country for a long time. Probably the most powerful media mogul in the country, maybe one of the most powerful in the world. I think he's found out that he lives in America. If you know anything about his background, he moved here from Australia. And he was arrogant enough not to the British Parliament wanted to bring him and his son in, and they wanted to ask him some questions, and at first he wasn't going to show up. Well, I guess he found out that they were serious, and now he's going to appear before Parliament. He has some serious, serious problems.
Good.
And you know what? If justice is applied and he's found guilty, you know what? I'm not going to shed a tear for this guy.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things. When you keep sticking your finger in somebody's eye, don't be surprised when they want to take you down. But what surprises me is if you look at this this acquisition that Murdoch's company is still going after and the state of New York is still going to go forward with, this $27 million no-bid contract to this Wireless Generation Corporation, which is an education firm. And look, education is where the money's going to be. And Murdoch said in an Adweek column, he said, when it comes to K-12 education, we see a $500 billion sector in the U.S. alone that's waiting desperately to be transformed. The money from our pockets to his. So it's interesting, and they got themselves a guy in this Joel Klein, who was the New York City school chief, who left the school system to go work for News Corp. So it's just all of this kind of interesting stuff that I hope all comes to the forefront of the pages of the press.
Well, I mean, some of these accusations are really slimy. If you read any of it in news reports, I mean, his people are accused of hacking into the phone of a murder victim. And by doing that, the police, their charges that they might have impeded a police investigation. I mean, they even hacked, and you mentioned it, they hacked into, some of the victims of 9/11.
They may have.
If it's true.
They may have.
If it's true. Their allegations, their charges, the FBI is investigating. That's good. But some of this stuff is really, really, I mean, how can anybody justify if it's true?
But at the end of this, what it says is we need to break up these major conglomerates. I mean, if you look at the map of the what he owns around the world, I mean, and it's Australia, New Zealand, it's Papua New Guinea, it's India, it's the Middle East, it's Europe, it's Latin America, it's Canada, it's the U.S., it's all over the place. And this is a global empire. And, you know, here's my problem. When you have the ability to shape the message, when you have the ability to change hearts and minds, when you have the ability to have your voice be the one that's heard, why is it surprising when we see policies that go against working people and for corporations? I mean, the fact that this News Corp is a very conservative company. They support very conservative outlets. And, you know, you look at the fact that they own HarperCollins Publishing, one of the biggest textbook companies in the country, on the globe, actually. That all filters through. It's amazing to me. And I've said it before. I would like to see these massive media conglomerates broken up into more manageable, more competitive entities. We should not have a global empire like this. That just flat out wrong.
Well, what troubles me is the modus operandi of Fox News and some of his news outlets. Fox News is to me more. I wouldn't call it a news channel. I would call it more a political channel. They tend to dramatically slant the news. I find that troubling. I really find that troubling. It all comes back to their owner.
Yeah, well, they're in it all. They're in the marketing. They're in book publishing. They're in satellite TV. They're in regular TV. They're in newspapers. They're you name it. They're there. Cable networks, the film industry. They're in everything. And it's this message machine that has really, and I don't think anyone can argue that News Corp isn't a conservative mouthpiece. So, you know, for most of us, I'm sure we'll be very happy to see Rupert Grint. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Fred McLucky from the Teamsters about this cross-border trucking issue. Right back after this. Show. Remember, check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Missed any portion of the program, our podcast is there for your entertainment and enjoyment. And yes, the border, I guess, is now going to be opened. They've signed the agreement. The ink is dry. I'm told we could be seeing Mexican drivers any day now. Things are moving in that direction. And I guess the question for me is has anyone learned the lesson that this is what happens when someone puts tariffs on things? Maybe we'll wake up and figure that out. But anyway, to talk about this cross-border trucking issue is Fred McLucky. He's the legislative director for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Teamsters.org is the website. Fred, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on tonight.
You know, I look at this, and the lesson that I'm taking from it, because the Mexican government, you got to give them credit, smart. They went and put tariffs on 92 products, 92 goods. That were well connected in our government, and we squealed.
Yeah, they were smart. They targeted some of our supporters in various states where they would hurt manufacturing and export of products to Mexico from those congressional districts. So. They obviously had some help. I think they had some help from some Washington,
maybe the Chamber of Commerce,
lobbyists, Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, to figure out who and what products they would put these tariffs on.
You know, when I look at this, I've yet to meet any average everyday working person, anybody like me, who's in favor of this. I think it's a bad idea, front to back, top to bottom. I think it's going to be bad for us as a nation. I think it's going to be bad for the industry. And more importantly, I think it's going to be bad for the economy because I'm expecting at least 100,000 job losses.
Well, it's probably the worst time to implement this program. As you said, I mean, we're in this deep recession, and we're basically saying it's okay to displace U.S. truck driving jobs and warehousing jobs along the border with allowing these Mexican truck drivers to cross our borders and perform long-haul service. Beyond that, we have a situation where the Mexican drug cartels are at war with each other, and trucking, we know, is the major way that the cartels move drugs into the United States. So they've actually been given a gift by our government in letting them move their product much easier and more with more ease throughout the United States with this long-haul trucking program.
I'm expecting immediate job losses because, as I understand it, and help me if I'm wrong here, but at the border currently, there are employees on both sides of the border that jockey these units back and forth. They've got drayage drivers who go back and forth in this 20-25 mile zone. I think all of those people in those warehouses and those jobs will be done because there's no need for them.
Exactly. I mean, we're looking at U.S. drivers who pick up those loads now that Mexican drivers have dropped off in the commercial zones, and they drive those that cargo into the interior of the U.S., whether it's Chicago or Milwaukee or Miami or anywhere else. And now it's going to be low-paid Mexican drivers transporting this cargo anywhere in the United States. Beyond that, it's these warehousing jobs that where the the cargo is dropped and waits for U.S. drivers to pick it up. Those jobs are going to be gone as well. And if they establish any anywhere housing. It's going to be in Mexico where they can pay low wages and no benefits.
You know, where we are up here in the 8178 corridor up here, there are a lot of big warehouses. And one of the things that I've been saying is don't be surprised if you start seeing an awful lot of empty warehouses as those folks move south of the border and end up having those drivers coming right from those warehouses that used to be here in Pennsylvania from Mexico to the stores here in Pennsylvania.
Sure. And all that product from the maquiladoras in Mexico that perhaps was transported by U.S. drivers. These companies, you know, looking for their bottom line profits, they're going to use these low paid Mexican workers to do that transported products now. We've got the situation where a lot of these Mexican trucks coming into the United States are going to be empty coming back, and we've got unscrupulous employers who are going to, you know, try to coerce these drivers into violating our cabotage laws and moving cargo from point A to point B in the United States, taking loads away from our U.S. drivers. So, and there's absolutely no confidence, at least in our eyes, that there's going to be any kind of enforcement of our cabotage laws that's going to prevent that from happening.
And if it is, it's going to be us paying for it. So we're going to end up being the losers anyway. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Fred McLucky, Legislative Director for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You know, have you done any studies, any thoughts on how many Mexican drivers are going to be coming into the U.S. On a regular basis? And have you done any studies on how many drivers from the U.S. may be going into Mexico? Because we keep hearing, well, the drivers are going to come into the U.S., the drivers from Mexico are coming to the U.S. Nobody is saying anything about American drivers going in Mexico, or is that just never going
to
happen?
Well, I think you'd have to have a screw loose to have U.S. drivers risk their lives, their cargo, and their equipment to go into Mexico right now. I talked to a trucking executive from a major trucking company a few weeks ago and said, well, are you ready to move your trucks into Mexico? And he told me, he said, We don't send any trucks into Mexico now or drivers for that matter. We do end up sending some trailers, and before we send those trailers into Mexico, we have a drop-off point where we take off all the new tires and anything of value on that trailer before we send it to Mexico, because we know if we send it in there, it's not coming back. Those new tires aren't coming back, and anything of value on that trailer isn't coming back. And for the most part, they have watched with some trailers equipped with GPS being taken into the desert for hours, unloaded, presumably, and brought back to the yards in the same position they were with half or three quarters of the cargo gone.
Right.
That's the way it is down there. It's like the Wild West. So I don't. You look at the travel advisory from April that was issued by the State Department, and you see that there's probably about 60 to 70% of Mexico that U.S. citizens are advised not to travel unnecessarily. And in fact, most or all of our U.S. employees that work in Mexico are advised to travel in armored vehicles. The cartels own the highways. They own the police down there. They run the country, and it's going to be very dangerous for any U.S. carriers to try to do business in Mexico.
Well, I'm sure they'll figure out a way, because we've got U.S. companies in places like Colombia and around the world where things aren't that safe. They just pay them off, and I'm sure they'll be fine. My problem with it is what happens to the workers. I've had a recent conversation with one of my MBA friends. And he was trying to explain to me from a business perspective, this was going to be good for the consumer because it's going to lower costs, and, you know, lower wages mean lower cost, and those costs would be passed on to us wonderful consumers, and how wonderful it was going to be. And I made the argument trucking deregulation was supposed to do the same thing. It didn't.
Exactly. I mean, they're looking at their bottom line, and they're seeing a low wage, no benefit workforce that can now move their product a lot cheaper than U.S. drivers can, and they're going to take every advantage of that. And it's just like gasoline prices. When gas prices drop, or the oil companies drop the gasoline prices, they take advantage of every nickel and dime that they can make. So to say that savings are going to be passed on the consumer, we'll have to wait and see. But don't hold your breath.
Yeah, as long as there's money out there, you're not going to see it. That's going to go into the corporate profit. It's going to go to the bottom line. So let me ask you, as crazy as this is to me, we're going to open up our border to a country that's basically in the midst of a civil war, taken over by a drug cartel. We're dealing with Homeland Security, where I'm being molested at the airport to make sure I'm not carrying a 4-ounce bottle of scope with me. Yeah, we're going to open up the southern border and not inspect every truck. Is there any way of stopping this?
Well, we're looking into that, Rick. We've held this thing up for close to 16 years now, and Congressman DeFazio from Oregon just introduced a bill this week, H.R. 2407, which allows the pilot program to go forward, but does some key things. It prevents the Department of Transportation from issuing permanent operating authority to these Mexican carriers, which they have agreed to do under their agreement that they recently signed. What really is disconcerting is that they're basically conceding that these Mexican trucks are going to be proven to be safe before the pilot program ever ends and is evaluated. Under the statutory language, these pilot programs are supposed to be run for a period of time. They're stopped. The data is collected. It's evaluated. It's analyzed, and it's determined whether the exception to the regulations is indeed a safe prospect for the U.S. Public. And DOT has seemed to put the cart before the horse and said, well, after 18 months, we're going to say that if these carriers pass a safety compliance review, we're going to give them permanent operating authority. And by the way, all of those carriers that participated in the Bush era demonstration project, we're going to give them credit for the time they were in the program. So we've got a situation where that program was defunded by Congress because of safety concerns, and DOT is saying, "Well, it's okay. We're still gonna give them credit for participating in a program that was discredited by Congress." So DeFazio's bill would prevent permanent operating authority of these Mexican carriers without the express authority granted by Congress. So we're working to build co-sponsorship for this bill, and hopefully we'll get enough support that we can find a vehicle to move this.
At the end of the day, last question I've got for you. At the end of the day, if we cannot stop this, is there anything being done to reach across the border? Are there Mexican trucking unions? Are there organizations that will help the workers on that side of the border to get a reasonable wage to help bring them up to somewhere near our standards?
Well,
so that it isn't a massive economic loss for us.
Well, that's been that is a goal that I think our union and other unions would like to see, but most of the Mexican unions are controlled by the government, and it's with the exception of the auto worker union in Mexico, most of these unions are shills for the companies and really don't offer any protection to the workers. So as much as I'd like to say that we could equalize the pay and benefits of these Mexican drivers like it is in Canada. I mean, we don't have problems with Canadian drivers. They're paid about the same wage and receive the same kind of benefits, and it's not an issue of competing with those Canadian drivers. There's no benefit to U.S. employers trying to seek them out and try to get them to take loads that belong to U.S. drivers because they're paying the same kind of wages and benefits. But I just don't see that happening with this situation for Mexico.
So much for the side agreements to NAFTA for labor and environmental protections.
Yeah, exactly.
Fred McLucky, I appreciate your time. Thanks for taking time for us to fill us in on this, and you know, whatever we can do to help to try and push this back.
Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America
through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can if you've got a smartphone, you can go download the Stitcher app and get our program there on Stitcher. Take it with you on the go wherever you are, and good stuff. Anyway, Carmageddon is going to be this weekend in Los Angeles as they're going to close down the 405, which is the nation's busiest highway. They need to do a $1 billion reconstruction project. It'll take about 53 hours over the weekend, and you got everybody out like we talked about last night. The mayor, they even brought Ponch back out of retirement and got him with his walker out there to say, stay home! But here's the thing. JetBlue is saying, no, don't stay home. No. Fly with us. $4. One way, taxes included, fees included. $4. We'll take you from Long Beach Airport to Bob Hope Airport in suburban Burbank. So they're gonna have four flights, 600 seats. All gone, sold out in 2 hours. So you know what? Folks in that area are gonna fly over the 405 because it's the over for the 405 special, where the planes will now, 600 tickets at $4 a piece. I don't even know if that's enough to pay for the gas, but it is a nice stunt, and it's one of those nice things, I guess, you know, get people to the beach and, out of the traffic. 600 people though. I mean, this highway. You're talking about 500,000 people a day. 500,000 people a day drive on this highway. And you know who the most famous person ever to drive on the road was? And we all watched it. What's the 405? It's the road that OJ drove his white Bronco on in that 9 mile an hour high speed chase back in 94. So there you go.
Football buddy.
Yeah, with Al Collins was his name.
Yes, defensive end, I believe.
Yeah, well, you know, hey. but again, you know, you look at the situation there, and just some simple construction. Carmageddon! Took me 45 minutes to get down Route 11, and I still have no idea why. No idea. None whatsoever. Why it took me 45 minutes to get from town, from where I live, which usually takes like 10 minutes, to the highway. 45 minutes today. No reason. Everywhere I went, traffic jams. Everywhere I went, bumper to bumper. And I'm going, it's Thursday afternoon. And you know what that tells me? It tells me our infrastructure is already outdated. And the reports bear it out. We're doing nothing. Well, we've done nothing. We've got leaders with no vision. There's no idea of what to do down the road.
And those visionless leaders are not just in Harrisburg and Washington. If you remember, in your county, Rick, the county where you live now, about 5 years ago they had the opportunity to appropriate money for that Corridor 1, which would have been light rail from Carlisle to Harrisburg and to Lancaster.
You know,
they voted it down.
I keep thinking about that. And
unbelievable.
Well, the people didn't vote it down.
Well, no, not the people. The county commissioners.
The county commissioners. And you go, what were you thinking? Oh, well, it wasn't cost effective. Well, you know what? Public transportation isn't. It's something that you invest in as a society. Say, you know, I want to get to work in under 4 days. Or here in Carmageddon, they're saying people are going to be backed up for 100 miles. It's going to be like China. You know, I was reading a story that the truck's going into Beijing. It takes them sometimes up to 9 days to get into Beijing. 9 days!
Is Beijing the largest city in the world now?
Well, it's one of the big. I don't know, but it's one of their big economic hubs. And for these trucks to get in and out of the city is just a nightmare, because there's nowhere for them to go. So they're backed up, and you go, where do you go to the bathroom? Where do you eat? Where do you do anything? And it's because they have. And look, they are investing heavily in infrastructure because they don't have it. They're spending money like it's going out of style. We're just not. We're not investing in any of these things. We're not investing in new technology at an acceptable rate. We're not putting money into infrastructure at an acceptable rate. You look at that bill that the Republicans put out. Everybody, I think even they know that they're underfunding it. And it's not going to even keep up with our failing infrastructure. It just doesn't make an awful lot of sense. And, like I talked about last night, the reality is we need jobs, man. We need a lot of jobs. Every time you turn around, we're losing more employment, especially in the public sector. The Republicans are doing everything they can possibly do to make sure that we don't recover, to make sure that we don't have enough jobs for folks. And, these green jobs, these are good jobs, mostly manufacturing. The people who put the solar panels on my roof, local people made a reasonable wage. I would love to see, I wish it was a prevailing wage job. But here we've got people in this state who, we want to exempt that. Because heaven forbid those folks make a really good wage. Oh, that they could plow back into the economy and hire other people. But that's a concept that, never mind. But these jobs, lots of them out there. And every time I turn around, all I keep hearing are Republicans going, we need to cut spending. Where are we going to cut spending? Cut spending from education, loss of jobs. Cut spending from health care, loss of jobs. Cut spending from transportation, loss of jobs. Cut that government, that evil government. When's the government going to start sacrificing? Cutting jobs. I mean, you stop and think about it for a little while. Look where we're at.
Well, if you remember, Rick, when the Republican governors in Ohio and Florida, took their office, they actually decided that they didn't want projects on high-speed rail that were already approved. We don't want that federal money. How far did these Republicans take this that would have produced, at least during the time of construction, several hundred thousand jobs? And then once it's built, you have a permanent infrastructure where you're creating even more jobs. And they turned it down. I mean, you wonder what kind of world do these people want to build? Amtrak. They want to basically make sure that Amtrak goes bankrupt. They've continually cut the funds, and it's basically the only railroad. It's not the only, but it's one of the few passenger railroads right now that's doing any business, and they want to cut the funding for it. I mean, where are we going with this?
Well, we're going to conservative worlds, what we've been talking about for the longest time, where everything that society wants and needs comes out of the bottom of your pocket. And it's painful. And it's expensive. That's what they want. You want fire protection? Going to have to subscribe. You want police protection? Going to have to subscribe. That's what we used to pay taxes for. And we're still paying taxes. Only they want to be able to take our tax dollars, hand it out to the big corporations and to the very wealthy, in the hopes that maybe possibly, please, sir, please, create a job. And it's not happening. It's just not happening. And if you stop thinking about it from a rational standpoint, all the money we've given to the wealth class, the trillions of dollars that we've allowed to float upwards to our investor class, what have they done with it? Have they been good stewards of the economy? Hell no. Look at the economy. It's in a shambles. Have they consumed all of that? Have they gone out and bought as much as they could? No. Because one person can only consume so much. Do you ever see the movie Brewster's Millions with Richard Pryor? It's one of those, it's kind of one of those where, gee, I wish I had that problem. But in the movie, he's supposed to, and I suggest you watch, it's a good one, John Candy and Richard Pryor. In the movie, Richard Pryor finds he's got a dead uncle who left him a boatload of money. And he has the opportunity to get like $600 million if he can spend $1 million every day for a month. They give him $30 million if he can spend $30 million in a month. But, And this is the catch. And all of us go, oh, I'd love to spend $30 million. Oh, it'd be so easy. But the catch was is you can't have anything at the end. You have to consume it. You have to basically just waste it. And, to help spur the economy. And, it showed how hard it would be. One person, $30 million, not happening. And there were some other parameters. But it's an interesting movie, but it's the concept is out there. If we give this $30 million to one guy, there's only so much of it he can possibly consume. But if we took that $30 million and we spread it over 30 million people, they're going to easily spend that $30 million. But we've forgotten that. And you know why we've forgotten it? Because we've been lobbied so heavily by the very, very well-to-do. Anyway, let's take a quick break. I'm going to come back right back after this with Ms. Conti from the National Employment Law Project. Stick around. We're right back after this. Hope not. Republicans on the Education and Workforce Committee, they want to reform the Fair Labor Standards Act, kind of like taking us back to the good old days, to the Lochner era, where we didn't have any of these worries about minimum wage, we didn't care about overtime, it was liberty of contract. If you're dumb enough to screw yourself, it should be that way, it shall be done. And they want to reform it. And what I found interesting is I listened to some of the testimony, and the business people were saying, whoa, it's not that we're breaking the law. No, it's that the law is broken. It's the law is broken. It's not us. It's you. So now you got Republicans are going, well, we need to reform this so it works well for business. Kind of makes you wonder how these laws that were to protect the workers of this country are now being perverted. Anyway, one of the people who was testifying in this, her name is Judy Conti. She is a federal advocacy coordinator at the National Employment Law Project. NELP.org is the website. Judy, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me to be with your show.
I appreciate it. I look at this and I'm going reform. They want to reform the the Fair Labor Standards Act, so it works better for business.
Yeah, I think the word you're looking for is deform.
Absolutely. I mean, but if you look at this and you go back and you the things when they passed this back in the 30s, Republicans were against it then.
They were. They're against it then. They've been against it ever since then. They're against it now. Not even Republicans necessarily per se. They're a bit opponents to good wage and hour laws from time immemorial. No matter what you do to change it, to improve it, to make it more modern, quote-unquote, the fact of the matter is that business still will come to Congress every year and whine about, it's so hard to comply with the law, it's so confusing, it's so ambiguous. I testified at this same hearing in 2002, and it was the same complaints. And here we are again in 2011, and it's the same complaints. And really what it comes down to, the biggest beef that the employer community has with it is the overtime exemptions. If you're considered a professional, then you're not covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And they just basically want to consider as many people as possible professionals so they can work them as many hours as possible and pay them as little money as possible. And that's really what it comes down to.
Or do like they've done in the trucking industry and just call them all, in the construction industry as well, call them independent contractors so we don't have to pay them any of that.
Exactly. The abuses with independent contractor misclassification are unbelievable. Not only do you lose protection of the wage and hour laws, you don't have workers' comp, you don't get unemployment insurance, you don't have any protections against discrimination. You've got to pay extra taxes, and the whole time the employer is not paying the taxes that they should. So they save on costs of about 30% of their personnel costs, and in doing so they're stealing from workers and they're stealing from taxpayers.
Absolutely.
And they're stealing from the government because that's money that should be going into the Treasury.
So is this the kind of reform they're talking about or no?
It is. Mostly the hearing today focused on these exemptions. Lynn Woolsey, who's the minority leader of the committee, and I both talked about independent contractor misclassification. The other witnesses didn't talk about that so much. Their big beef is that it's so hard to figure out who's a professional and who's not and who should be exempt and who's not. And they don't think that the FLSA allows them a lot of flexibility to respond to the modern workforce. The reason why they're not letting people telecommute, the reason why they're not trusting workers to make their own schedules and do more of their work on the time that is most convenient to them, to come and go early for family needs, to do some work at home. The reason for that isn't that they don't trust their workforce and they're trying to keep a tight thumb on people. The reason is the Fair Labor Standards Act just won't let them do it. It's too gosh darn hard.
Yeah, so when they're spending 80 hours a week at home doing the work that, you know, would take 100 hours, it's just too hard to keep track of.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, again, you know, you look at this, and at some point, some rational thought has to take in. Look, we need rules, and there's probably some areas where we should be updating them, but not in the direction that I'm seeing things going.
Exactly. You know, the direction that the business witnesses were talking about was all in the direction of covering fewer and fewer people. And these rules definitely need updating every decade or so. There's no doubt about that because things do change. But the fact of the matter is that things don't change so much that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, at the heart and soul of the FLSA is a minimum wage, is equal pay for equal work, protections against unreasonable workloads, spreading work out among many people instead of a few, and an end to child labor. And none of those priorities has changed in the least. They're all as important today as they were in 1938 when Francis Perkins and FDR passed the Fair Labor Standards Act.
You know, you bring up the child labor thing, and here recently we've seen a lot of attacks on child labor. Mm-hmm. The one with Senator Cunningham in Missouri pretty much wanting to gut the entire state of Missouri's child labor enforcement department, and with some really bizarre bizarre statements with that as well.
Yeah, fortunately, in Maine, they actually rolled back some child labor laws. The proposal was to put a sub-minimum wage for youth workers and to allow young workers to work later at night. They were able to beat back the sub-minimum wage, but I believe Maine just did change its laws so that children can work longer hours and later in the night.
11 o'clock on school nights. Because you know what? They don't need education. They just need to learn how to say, do you want fries with that?
Exactly.
It's nuts. But in this economy, they're out there competing with their parents for the same, you know, minimum wage service sector jobs. So we need to give the child the comparative advantage.
You know, it's just, it kind of defies reason right now. I mean, obviously there are certain fringes that have been looking for opportunities to roll back these important protections for years and decades. It just does sort of boggle my mind, though, that they're using the economic downturn as a justification to do it, as if low-wage workers, as if children workers were the problem, as if, you know, public servants and government workers are the reason why we're in a recession. It just seems like there's a real effort to try to restore fiscal sanity and restore, American prosperity on the backs of those who did nothing to cause the recession and who are suffering the worst from it. And to say that it defies logic is probably an understatement.
And one of the things, and I go back to this quite often, and one of the things I had hoped for this president, back when he took office in January of 2009, was that he would be remembered as the president who saved work in this country and rewarded work. And I was really hoping that some labor law reform would happen to allow workers to organize and to have a voice in the workplace. I was really hoping that would happen. It didn't. And now, as you've pointed out, we're seeing people being exploited. You're seeing wage gains being taken back. I talk to people all the time who are saying the contract gains that they've had over generations are now being stolen from them.
It really is true. I mean, you know, it's a shame that the Employee Free Choice Act was scuttled so quickly. And obviously there are many workers' rights advocates that had hoped that there would be not only legal reforms, but, you know, there's certainly been lots of regulations that the Department of Labor has been promising to issue and hasn't yet, and that's been disappointing. But we need to remember that during the previous 8 years, the Department of Labor lost more and more funding, more and more staffing every year. It is probably the federal agency that started the new administration in the deepest hole, and there's been a lot of devoted attention to rebuilding that agency and getting it back in working order. They've done that in fairly good order over the last 2 years. Yes, we'd like more. Yes, we'd like better. Yes, we'd like it to be more aggressive, but I do keep reminding myself of the perspective of how far out of a hole they had to climb, and they did so fairly well in a relatively short period of time, and especially during the recession when claims are rising, when the problems are just so much greater. It was even a larger challenge than it ordinarily would have been.
Yeah, I mean, the Bush administration did starve the department and put somebody in charge of it who thought it was best served to be the Department of Business instead of the Department of Labor.
Right. We already have a Department of Commerce. We don't need another one.
You know, I remember going back to the Bush years, and this is kind of off topic, but, you know, they used the NLRB to push through the Kentucky River cases, which stole, and kind of going along with the Fair Labor Standards Act here as well, stole people's rights to organize because they misclassified them as supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it plays kind of in this as well. If you can then declare them supervisors, you can make them salary and not have to worry about the minimum wage or worry about the
overtime. Exactly, and it allows an employer to save an awful lot of money.
But
it
had a nice
isn't going back into the pockets of workers and isn't being used to hire other workers. It's just being used to increase corporate profits mostly these days.
Yeah, but you know what they give the worker instead? Instead of wages and the ability to feed their family and you know, prosper and do better, they give them a nice title.
Well, you know, it's so funny. One of the witnesses today is the HR director for IBM. He was, he's a good American patriot and loves his country and loves his job and feels that it's his sworn patriotic duty to fight for reform of the FLSA. He told a tale of woe when they were sued a number of years ago on behalf of 7,000 workers and voluntarily and quickly reclassified them as non-exempt and started paying them on an hourly basis, not admitting any wrongdoing, of course. And in doing so, also gave them all pay cuts of 15%, supposedly to make up for the overtime they were going to have to start paying them. But it was very clear from the very beginning that at least a third of the workers never had worked overtime, never would work overtime, but they still got the 15% pay cut for the, you know, adjustment to the wages. He told the tale of woe of how, you know, over half of these workers contested their reclassification. One woman cried on his shoulder. She was so upset. They were professionals who were so upset that they were now non-exempt because it didn't befit them. Instead of realizing that the reason they were contesting and crying on people's shoulders is because they got pay cuts. Nothing in their job changed, and they got pay cuts.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do, you know, and this is something I've been wrestling with, and it's kind of rhetorical. Why do we put up with this? I mean, I've heard these stories from numerous people, yet we still have this vision that there's a benevolent corporation out there who gives us jobs. It's like bestowing this gift upon us. And I've been trying to explain to folks, there's no such thing as a benevolent corporation. They're decent employers. But at the end of the day, if they can't make a buck off of what you're doing, you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
There's no benevolent corporation.
Well, and it's true. I mean, you know, if we want to hail capitalism as the be-all and end-all, we have to realize that, you know, there's no warm fuzzies around it. It's you know, a sheer calculating decision of profit and how much you want to make and how you're going to get there to do it. Now, there are decent ways to do it. And as you said, there are an awful lot of good employers out there. I don't mean
certainly
to point everybody with a broad brush. But, you know, just we hear the same drumbeat year after year. It's the same darn argument about how complicated the FLSA is. It's a job killer. Well, you know, nowadays everything's a job killer. Taxes are job killers. Regulations are job killers. Laws are job killers. Unions are job killers. The National Labor Relations Board is a job killer. Everything's a job killer. Well, let's just eliminate them all. Let's make it the wild, wild west, and employers can do whatever they want, however they want, and you see how long it takes before we have another Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire.
Excellent point. And that evil, nasty minimum wage costs us jobs.
Yes, even though every reputable academician who has studied minimum wage increases, you know, county to county, state to state, and even during the most recent recession, has proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that they don't cost jobs. In fact, they probably help stimulate the economy in ways that will ultimately create jobs. But why should we let the truth get in the way of a good talking point?
Yeah, you and your reading.
I know. I'm one of those, you know, I guess I'm one of those silly elites that doesn't really know how the real world works.
Judy Conte, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much for the update on this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good night to you and all of your listeners.
All righty. Have a great night. She's the Federal Advocacy Coordinator at the National Employment Law Project, NELP.org, if you want some more information. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just one more day, just to play the game, but the castle's crumbling.
Yeah, running with the devil. You got it. Rick Santorum in the news. The devil incarnate himself, I believe. You know, couldn't you just see in that high forehead he's got two little horns coming right out near the temples there? Just little horns. Couldn't you see that? I think I can. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, he writes, you got to love this, at a time when voters have grown skeptical about politicians and candidates who run on certain platform, only to backtrack once elected, signing a pledge is a good way to strengthen our political promises. He writes, every candidate once elected pledges by oath or affirmation to execute his or her duties of office in compliance with the laws of that state and country and constitution. But the pledges we see today are oaths to voters on how a candidate will execute those lawful duties if given the privilege of being elected. And he goes through this whole thing on why he signs these bizarre pledges and why he gets himself into it. And I got to be honest with you, it's all dumb. I think these pledges are just plain stupid. And I guess what it's for. The simple-minded need to know that the person that they're voting for is never going to change their mind, is never going to compromise, and is never going to do anything other than what's on the paper. And, you know, for me, what that tells me is that we lack critical thinking skills. You know, I've got friends who read the Constitution and say, well, that isn't written right in there in black and white, and it's not explicitly written. And you go, well, there's a concept. You know, the Commerce Clause, one of them. You know, the general welfare. You know, there's a lot of big ideas there. A lot of things can fit under that. And no, it's not written there in black and white. It's got to be written out there. And the founders, you know, back in, 1776, you know, they, or 1781, they had to write it out explicitly. Like, you know, when airplanes land, they've got to make sure that they have a runway, even though they didn't have airplanes. You know, in their world, nothing ever changed. It's the same as it was back in the 1770s. And for me, I look at these pledges, and I ask the question, do we want these sheep of politician running to these crazy groups? Do you want them going to crazy group XYZ? I mean, look at Michelle Bachmann. She wanted to get to be the first to sign that pledge so fast that she didn't even bother reading it. I mean, didn't even bother reading the pledge. And if you look at these things, they're really recipes for disaster. Look at what's going on in Congress right now. Look at what's going on in Washington. They can't come to a rational conclusion to our debt ceiling problems, even though every story you hear, Moody's is looking at changing our ratings. The Chinese are looking at changing ratings. There's a whole bunch of negative things on the horizon. They can't come up with an agreement. And from my perspective, the Republicans have taken this, every Republican in Congress, all 235 Republicans in the House and 41 in the Senate, have taken this Norquist pledge not to raise taxes. So they've taken this very narrow-minded, simplistic pledge to say, I'm never going to do it, never. Don't care what the conditions are. Not compromising. Not going to do it. And they're going to hold us hostage so that they can, I'm going to keep my word. I kept it to some guy named Grover. The country be damned. And I ask you, is this how our nation got to this point? Is this how we became the greatest, most powerful nation in the history of the world? I say, no, it's not. Understand, you know, every one of those Republicans who signed that pledge, they represent me too. I may not agree with them all the time, but they represent all of us. So when they take these bizarre pledges that we're never going to consider changing our mind under any circumstance, I say, well, what if you're wrong? What if what you're doing is taking us down the wrong path? I mean, I would love to hear some politician stand up and say, I do hereby swear my honor, my sacred honor, that I'll never sign some dumb pledge ever, period. And like in Bachmann's case, especially one that you haven't read yet, especially one that handcuffs you and doesn't allow you to compromise or find common ground. You know, I mean, are we really that beholden to the close-minded, slush-brain, vitriolic mental midgets who have double-digit IQs, not smart enough to realize that we've been misled by these pledges, that these radical right groups have mistreated them and used them? I mean, really? I mean, to be honest, pledges are just plain silly. I want our elected officials to have all the facts in front of them and make a rational decision. Now, look, you can have a position on taxes that, you know, I don't want to raise taxes. And I wouldn't want to either. But there comes a point where you say, yes, we want war. We want to have two wars. We've decided that. How do we pay for it? If you go back to the Bush years, they said, yeah, we're going to have wars, but we want tax cuts too. So they spent a boatload of money on wars and a boatload of money on tax cuts, and then we're in this position where we can't afford them anymore. And I don't see anybody rushing to say, I don't see many people rushing to say, bring everybody home, cut our losses and come back. I don't see anybody saying, you know, we need to cut off those tax handouts. It's costing us too much. What I'm seeing people saying, cut Medicaid, cut Medicare, slash into Social Security, ruin what's left of our tattered safety net. And we've got, you know, Snow White here, Michelle Bachmann, and the seven dwarfs running behind them, dying to sign these pledges, except for Huntsman. They got to give Huntsman credit. He's the only guy who said, no, I'm sorry, not doing it. And what scares me is even with Michelle Bachmann's insanity, she's still gaining ground. She's still becoming more popular, moving up the polls in the Republican Party. The latest Quinnipiac poll has her, you know, right up there sniffing at Mitt Romney's heels. And you go, why? Why, Jake? Why? When you listen to her, she's off on the radical fringe.
Well, but unfortunately for the nation, first of all, I don't think she has a very good chance of being president. I think her chances are very nil. However, she reminds me a lot of Palin. She appeals to the right wing. And then you have Mitt Romney, who right now, people are complaining. He's disappeared the last couple of weeks. Where is he? I don't perceive him as a strong candidate either. So, plus you're talking about the first primary is Iowa, and the Republicans out there tend to be more conservative. But, you know, I think that would be the absolute, any chance that the Republicans have if they nominate her, you can just throw it away. There is no way that woman can become president, Rick. She's just said too many things that make no sense. And everybody makes mistakes. But some of the things she said, such as lifting the debt ceiling, here's someone, President of the United States, is saying, page, well, that's okay. I mean, we can do this and trickle around it here and there, and it'll be all right. We don't have to lift the debt ceiling. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And this woman wants to be president? That's scary. That is absolutely scary.
The good thing is Palin's not raising as much money as they thought she was going to. In fact, first half of this year, she's raised only $1.6 million, which isn't chump change. But when you're looking at the fact that, you know, Mitt Romney had $18.25 million, Sarah Palin raised a boatload of money. Something along some $4 million, I think she raised. Hopefully she's just going to be forgotten. I would just love to forget her.
I'm not so sure that's going to happen, Rick.
Yeah, I hope we forget her. When we come back, we're going to talk with Bo Hadai. He's written a great piece, Publicopoly Exposed, How Alec and the Koch Brothers and Corporate Allies Plan to Privatize Our Government. And here in the state of Pennsylvania, how they plan on privatizing public education and our state wine and spirits shops. We're right back after this.
There is only IBM, ITT, and AT&T, and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Well, that seems to be the direction we're going. Our stat of the day, if the U.S., the top 1% in the U.S., the income had only increased as fast as national productivity since 1980, according to Paul Buckheit. The nation's top 1% would now be taking about $1 trillion less out of the U.S. economy. And that's $1 trillion that could have trickled down to the rest of us. Could have maybe been used to build infrastructure, maybe been used to fund education, maybe to fund health care. But instead, we've made the choice to allow that $1 trillion to rise up to the very top and make their lives much easier. And what's amazing, to use that money against us. And I point to this piece by Bo Hadai. He's written Publicopoly Exposed, how Alec, the Koch brothers, and their corporate allies plan to privatize. There's a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Bo Hadai's name. It'll take you right there. Bo, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be on your show.
You know, I look at this piece, and it's going to open a lot of people's eyes, I hope, because most people, I don't think of Alec. Can you tell me what that is?
Well, Alec is the American Legislative Exchange Council. It bills itself as being the nation's largest public-private legislative partnership. On the public side of things, you have about 2,000 of the nation's state-level lawmakers, which is about a third of those lawmakers in the nation. On the private side, you have about 250, although the numbers vary, member corporations and special interest groups, as well as think tanks. You know, corporations range anywhere from ExxonMobil, Corrections Corporation of America, Pfizer, and on Walmart. The think tanks include many of these Koch-funded think tanks, such as Cato, also the Heritage Foundation, which was co-founded by Alec's founder, Paul Weyrich. And as far as special interest groups go, a good example of that would also be the National Rifle Association.
You know, I look at that, and you talk about these big corporations. You talk about the legislature. In your piece, you wrote, Alec's stated aim is to provide, quote, more effective, efficient government via privatization, that is, shifting the government functions to the private sector. Didn't they? They used to have a word for that. It was called fascism.
it's possible. They are certainly determined in what they're doing, and that is certainly their goal, as evidenced by pieces of model legislation discussed in the article, aimed at the political efficacy and viability of public employee unions and all unions, as a matter of fact. And these model pieces of model legislation are often accompanied by bills which state to establish privatization councils or commissions, which basically mandate privatization, which in some cases actually have statutory power to compel privatization of state agencies.
You know, I've been talking for the longest, you know, since January about the wave that's going across this country, the privatization, the busting up of unions, the defunding of education, the privatization of what is ours, what belongs to we to the people, handed over to the corporations. And I've been saying, look, this seems like it's coming out of a playbook, and it's just being passed around. And basically what you're telling me is this Alec group, they're one of the people behind it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it is. It's funny because it basically is a playbook. A vast amount of the anti-union stuff was distributed by a legislative handbook or playbook, if you want to call it that, distributed by Associated Builders and Contractors Incorporated as their 2010 legislative handbook. All of the paycheck protection and laws, or excuse me, pieces of model legislation, as well as Alec's Right to Work Act and other things. A bill is in there that seeks to preempt, I believe, the minimum working wage. And there's other lovely things in there that basically are not good for workers.
Well,
and it is a playbook.
Reform the Fair Labor Standards Act by reforming it so it works for business. Because businesses don't break the laws. The laws are just broken.
Right. Laws are apparently standing in their way.
Absolutely. You know, and I look at this, and, you know, I've got some, I know a number of legislators, and they're decent. They're good people. But, you know, for the most part, I don't know that the most ambitious folks when it comes to actually writing legislation. So what I find interesting is a lot of these pieces of legislation look mighty similar. It looks like somebody may have cut and pasted a bunch of portions of it. And I look to this, you know, what you've laid out, and a lot of it's that, I think.
Sure. If you look at it, I don't have the specific name of the bill in front of me, but one of the earlier versions of one of these pieces of model legislation, it calls for the creation of a privatization and efficiency council. Now, it is unclear who authored that specific piece of model legislation. What is known, though, is that a subsequent version, which was strikingly similar to that piece of model legislation, was recently introduced into ALEC by Leonard Gilroy of the Reason Foundation. And what he'd basically done was taken this previous piece of ALEC model legislation and really beefed it up to compel, as we were discussing earlier, privatization of state agency functions. And, of course, Leonard Gilroy is the, I believe, vice president of governmental affairs or something like that with the Reason Foundation. And is a Koch-funded, I believe it's David Koch, who's actually on their board of directors, as well as Richard Fink as well, I believe, of Koch Industries. And Reason is a, you know, quote, libertarian think tank that seeks to promote privatization itself. And I know for a fact also that Reason in the past has also taken donations, contributions from such entities as Corrections Corporation of America, which, of course, also has a huge stake in privatization of governmental functions.
Sure, because, you know, we've got the most prisoners in the world, no matter how you count them, by sheer number, by per capita. We've got more people locked up than anywhere on this planet.
Right.
And it's a good growth industry, good profits being made from it.
Right, and to come sort of full circle with that, we have, in large part, ALEC to thank for that. It was during the 1990s when Corrections Corporation of America was chair of their I believe then it was called the Criminal Justice Task Force, and currently it's called the Public Safety and Elections Task Force. CCA was at that time, during the 1990s, chair of that task force. And during that time, we saw in states all of these laws based on no...
Three strikes and you're out.
Yeah, three strikes and you're out. Three strikes and you're out, truth in sentencing, mandatory minimums, all of these things that have, criminalized certain behavior to a greater extent than it was criminalized before, and calling for longer prison stints and all that.
Yeah, because the longer we can keep people locked up, the more profit we can make. You look up here where we're at here in central Pennsylvania, just up the road in the Scranton area, they had two judges that got thrown in jail for, being bribed for giving long sentences to teenagers for doing nothing to put into the private prisons.
Right. And, you know, I believe that that's also something that you see as a problem with these industries that are deeply involved in privatization, is because it is actually good for business to influence those in the public sector that hold the, you know, the purse strings, or you know, if every kid going into jail has a dollar sign on their head, you definitely want to bribe those judges to get them in there, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
So it's good business to be corrupt.
But that's not good for government. It's not good for society. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Bo Haddai. He's written a great piece, Publicopoly Exposed, How ALEC, the Koch Brothers, and Their Corporate Allies Plan to Privatize Government. You can take a look at that at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Bo Haddai's name. It'll take you right there. I was talking to a state legislator here in Pennsylvania the other day, and she said, you know, for the first time in her career, she has seen really just a massive influx of cash and a lot of outside, out-of-the-state groups coming in, especially these right-wing groups, trying to influence policy here, which is why I think we're seeing, you know, them wanting to privatize public education, them wanting to privatize our state wine and spirits shops, basically sell off every asset, every activity of government in this state. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how it's now coinciding with all of these outside groups, the Americans for Prosperity, the Freedom Works, all of those groups.
Right. Yeah, it really is astounding, the scope of this thing. And you look at the amount of work that has gone into it, it's impossible to say that it's not a concerted action or agenda on a national scale. And it's also very interesting to note that, you know, groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, you know, a close cousin of Americans for Prosperity, and also, of course, going back to the Kochs. But these groups were responsible in large part for the, you know, the Republican Revolution Part Two that we saw last year with the so-called Tea Party stuff. And, you know, it's absolutely this, these sweeps that they've had with these really hardline, GOP individuals that they've got in there now have been vital in the, implementation of this plan, because you look at a lot of these pieces of model legislation, and they had been kicking around in one form or another for several years, you know, some of them going well back into the 80s or 90s. But I don't believe that they've had this kind of broad base of support. And, of course, the you know, the ironic and beautiful thing is that they're the ones who put this base of support there in large part.
You know, I look at this, and again, it comes back down to money. And it, what I started this segment out with, the stat that I talked about, you know, it had the wealth at the very top grown at the same rate as productivity. The economy, the working people of this country, the taxpayers would have gotten $1 trillion more dollars that the wealth class wouldn't have been able to use against us. And you look at all this wealth, all of the tax breaks we've given, all of the welfare that we've given these big corporate titans, our robber barons of this era, and they're using it against us.
Right. And, you know, a truly scary thing, I think, is what you see with all these cuts to education as part of these reactions to budget crises and, you know, calls to privatize educational functions and all this is very scary, because the worse education gets, the harder it's going to be for us to dig ourselves out of the hole that we are currently in. And you have to start with education. If the education isn't there, ignorant populace, it's going to be very easy to push down further.
And to continue to mislead, you know, in bringing up education, you know, I look at the, I don't know if you saw this story down in Florida, Florida State University, evidently got some money from the Koch brothers so that the Koch brothers would have say in who they hired in their economics department. To me, that's scary, scary stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. If you look at the Charles Koch Foundation's tax returns, they're actually very interesting, because for some reason or other, the Charles Koch Foundation actually lists who they give money to, where, you know, that's sort of an uncommon thing to see with a lot of these groups, but there's a good itemized list of everybody they give money to.
And all they're brazen about it.
Yeah, they're brazen about it. And so it's not only Florida State University. You see several universities on there supported by them. I don't have all the names in front of me, but it apparently is part of their strategy to do that.
And you know what's amazing to me, Bo?
Yeah.
How little it took. How little money it took to have that kind of say. I mean, it was only a couple million dollars.
Right, right. It is interesting. And, you know, I don't know why that is. You know, when I first started doing this stuff, I was thinking, well, as far as lawmakers are concerned, you see how often it seems a relatively small contribution seem to sway them. And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe it's just that their campaigns are well-financed and they're constantly scrambling for the littlest thing. But, you know, to me, it just seems that there is perhaps such a vacuum of opposition that, you know, you give somebody a little bit of money to shoot them a certain way, and they're not necessarily going to disagree with you. So it doesn't take a large amount of money to sway people when there isn't much education as to what's going on, or any sort of strong opposition to what's going on.
Yeah, excellent point. The piece is Publicopoly Exposed, How Alec, the Koch Brothers, and Their Corporate Allies Plan to Privatize Government. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. It'll take you right to the article. Bo Hedaya, I appreciate the time. This is a really fantastic article. Nice, compact. Gets the message out there for folks. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rick.
All right, have a great night, man. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. That's an interesting question for this next story. UPI is reporting that a woman from Tennessee was charged with disorderly conduct after she refused to allow an airport screener to pat down her daughter. Her daughter, you know, is 6 years old and said, look, you know, not too thrilled about that. And the woman said, no, not going to happen. Then she got irate and she, you know, stomped and screamed and swore at the TSA. And they said, no, we're not going to take it. And they arrested her and took her away. She's been released on bond. But, you know, here's the thing. Again, you know, at some point we're going to have to make this decision. At some point, we've got to either decide we're not going to do this and appease all these folks. And look, I don't want to be strip searched at the airport. I don't want to be patted down. You know, we've seen stories where now the quote-unquote terrorists are surgically implanting bombs in people. So eventually we maybe have to go through, you know, like our luggage, through x-ray machines to make sure there's nothing inside. When does it stop? When does this insanity stop? Especially when you see now that according to government reports, our airports over the past 10 years have had more than 25,000 security breaches. They've had 14,000 people enter limited access areas by going through airport doors or passageways without permission. So basically you're looking at a problem of controlling that as well. And I'm going, at some point, don't we have to say, look, there's a way that we can do this that's rational. There's a way that we can do this that's not invading personal space, that's invading your rights. Then my problem becomes, what happens when you let down your guard and we end up back where we were? And, you know, we've already forgotten 9/11. In fact, you know, Fox News, somebody was on Fox today. You know, his name's Eric Boiling or something along those lines. He said this really stupid.
Was America certainly safe between 2000 and 2008? I don't remember any terrorist attacks on American soil during that period of time.
He said we were certainly safe between 2000 and 2008. I don't remember any terrorist attacks during that time.
Light bulb.
Let me let you in a little something there, Eric. 2001 was between 2000 and 2008. Had a major terrorist attack. But, you know, you look at this, and again, I like my idea. My idea is a very sound idea. Good principles. You should just fly naked. Put everything in the, you know, go everything through the x-ray machine, all of our clothes, everything. Fly naked. Simple.
Yeah, but there's one problem with that.
What's the problem with that, Jake?
You'd have to have a lot of vomit bags for the passengers.
If you don't like it, don't look.
Okay. That might be hard to do on a plane, though, Rick.
That's why they have magazines and movies. Yeah, we're too hung up. We're too pent up of a society. Okay. We're too worried about everybody else.
The nudist colony attitude we need.
Okay. Well, my father-in-law says he went to nudist camps a lot. And they don't even look at each other anymore. I'm going, well, what's the point of going to a nudist colony then if you're not going to look? And he said they don't. It's
well,
very odd.
One thing, if we start flying naked, that'll probably increase the ridership.
You know, here's the thing. I thought these pat-downs would increase the ridership. You know, I thought lonely people who need a friend, you know, man, there you go.
I don't even think in the Israelis require their passengers to... To drive me,
now,
you know,
the adult conversation in this has to be, do you start profiling people? And, you know, do you see the guy who's jittery in line who, you know, yeah, maybe you start looking at people. And maybe you start looking at people who, you know, may not be Arab or may not be, because I look back to Oklahoma City. Nobody would have ever thought him.
Well, I think maybe we have two problems here. First of all, you know, these airlines are probably going to fight some of these security suggestions from the federal government because it'll all come down to the bottom line for them. I guess the question I have we really taken the advice of, let's say, the Israelis? The Israelis have an awful lot of history of fighting terrorism and attacks a tax on planes and a tax on their country. Have we conferred with them? Have we done everything that's practical and yet would increase our security? I'm not so sure we have, but that's a tough problem. And you know, Rick, that some of these airlines will fight depending on what the federal government suggests. Some of these airlines will fight it purely on economic grounds. That's another problem we have, political influence in Congress.
Well, here's the thing. The Israeli, and there was a guy who testified, a security consultant, a guy named Rafi Ron. He's a former security director of the Tel Aviv airport there. He was saying we should be spending more of our time focusing on bags, on the stuff that gets through, and maybe not as much on, strip searching people. Because he was saying, look, I can get stuff through. Not that hard. For me, it comes down to something very simple. The reality is sometimes bad things happen. And I don't know that we should be giving up our rights, giving up our ability to not be molested. But what I do know is while the right is complaining about this, and we should privatize this, it should be the airports who are doing this, the second this goes into the hands of private for-profit corporations, you lose your right to say anything about this. Then it becomes a private property issue. Now that the government's doing it, everybody's bitching about it. Everyone's complaining about it. But as we move down the road, once they privatize it, and look, there's a movement to privatize this, to put it into the hands of the airports and to the airlines. Once they do that, one of two things happens. We either have much tighter security restrictions, much worse than you imagine now, draconian, massive racial profiling, massive pat-downs, you name it, they're going to do it, or they're going to go the other way. We're going to pander to customer service. We're not going to do anything whatsoever other than what we were doing before 9/11. The question then becomes, if we go that route, what happens when someone decides to take another plane and fly it into a building if they can? Or when one goes down? That's what's, those are questions that have to be answered. And it has to be answered by the nation as a whole. Look, at the end of it, those are your choices. It's that simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, we're going to talk to Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there for your enjoyment, your entertainment. Also, you can go to our website or on your smartphone and download the Stitcher app. The Rick Smith Show is now on Stitcher, so you can take it with you on your smartphone. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. It's tough times right now. The economy's rough. There's a lot of competition for the few jobs that are available. There have been a whole bunch of conversation about what do you do on a job interview? How do you act? More importantly, how don't you act? This latest story I came across with the Robert Half firm publishing a summary of the worst case scenarios from hiring managers. Evidently, you had some managers who came out with some bad memories of applicants. One guy came in for an interview with a cockatoo on his shoulder. I'm guessing he didn't get the job. Another annoying interviewee came in and sang all of her requests, sang them all. Another one came in and handcuffed himself to the desk during the interview. Some of the other folks came out a little too honest. Yeah, you want to be honest with the interview, but, the one guy said, you guys got nice benefits, and that's good because I'm going to need to take a lot of leave in the next year. So that's one of those things. Have you ever gone on some of the interviews and said something dumb?
Can I ask the dumb question?
Yeah,
was that guy hired?
I would be willing to bet my last dollar.
That's a pretty safe bet that he wasn't picked.
Not gonna happen. I did go on a job interview one time where they asked if you'd be willing to take a lie detector test. Mm. And I said, yeah, right after you. Needless to say, I didn't get that job.
But in defense of the guy, that is a good reason. He needs a job, so, you know, he can take off a lot.
Oh, but coming in, handcuffing yourself to the desk, I don't know. That's a little weird for my taste. Anyway, yesterday we were out at Metro Bank Park hitting a couple of baseballs for breast cancer. And you know, I had a good time doing that and enjoyed it. And I see this story in North Carolina where, you know, some folks supporting support groups for breast cancer survivors, they have put up a pink portable toilet with a pink picket fence and fake windows just to raise awareness to breast cancer and also to raise some money. And, you know, I'm going, gee, isn't there a better way of doing this? But they gussied it up real nice. This portable toilet now looks like a little house, and they got plantation shutters on the outside with some flower boxes, and it's got, you know, some information on the group there, Carolina Breast Friends, which is kind of funny in a way. But you know, it's one of these way to make money. And the sad thing about it is, and this is one of those things that bothers me, and I didn't really go into this yesterday, you know, about the event we went to. I'm sorry. It's a great cause, and it's great that things are happening like that, and it's great to see people coming together. But at the end of it, shouldn't we be investing this in this as a nation? Shouldn't this be a priority? Shouldn't this be something that we say, you know, we don't want to leave the bake sales and batting cages. We really, as a nation, think that it's important to research this stuff, which is why, you know, I remember, you know, doing in the Jerry Lewis telethons. The guy's raised hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. And I've always said, you know, is that how we should be funding that? Shouldn't it be as a matter of course? Shouldn't it be a part of what we, the people, do? And look, he did a great job. I guess he's not doing it anymore. And I'm not sure where it's going to go from here. But again, you know, it's one of those things. Here's a story that's going to catch your eye, Jake. And I can see you doing this. If you were an Ohio State fan, you're not, obviously. You're Penn State or whatever it is. This guy died. And the family took a picture with the open casket of the deceased guy. And they all stood out there and they formed the letter.
The O.
The Ohio. Oh,
they didn't.
And the dead guy was the I. And I was talking about this today. I go, I could really see you doing something like this.
It sounds like the guy was a real hardcore Ohio State fan.
Yeah. Well,
and he might have had it in his will.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was in the will, but, you know, they did it because, you know, the guy loved the Buckeyes. He was a fun-loving guy, and was a way to give him a tribute.
If that gives him peace in the next world, hey, who are we?
And what's weird is, you know, the picture's on the front of the paper there. I'm a little weird with that. But, you know, good for him.
That's something you wouldn't do, I'm assuming.
No, in fact, we were talking about this, you know, the whole death thing. I've told my wife, I said, if you can put me out with the recyclables and the trash man will take me away, go that route. It's cheaper. Because the whole funeral industry to me is a complete ripoff. I mean, that whole thing is just a scam in my opinion. And they, you know, they've got you at the worst time, the worst possible time ever, where they're going to take advantage of you and really stick it to you. And you know, that's their job. That's how they make a profit and whatever. But for me, I said, you know, they'll take me out with the trash. Do that. If you can get someone to buy me, you know, go that route too. That's a good to go.
Sell your parts.
That's right.
Sure.
But get some money off it. Don't spend money to get rid of me. And don't you know? And I don't want to have a funeral service. I don't want people coming to make sure.
Question.
What?
Is it legal to be buried in your own backyard?
No, it's not.
I didn't think so.
You know,
but you would if you could.
Absolutely. Just about 18 inches under the ground, so I decompose quickly. The problem with our system, and you know, and I did some research on this years ago, and it's one of these crazy, weird things that I actually did research on. You know, this whole idea of putting people in a cement box is just dumb, because you never decompose, you never ashes to ashes. It takes 1,000 years for that stuff to decompose, and for you to ever get near the environment. In fact, you'll explode before you'll decompose. And the whole reason they put you in these cement crypts or these cement boxes before they put you in, you know, put your box inside the box, is so they can cut the grass. That's the only reason for that. so that they don't have those ruts in the grass so that they can run the mower over them. It's insane. It's just plain nuts. Just nuts. And then they put you in an airtight casket. How are you supposed to go back to dust and dirt in an airtight casket that's going to take 1,000 years to break down? I say put you about 18 inches underground, wrapped in a sheet. Let the bugs get to you. They need a good meal every once in a while, too. Speaking about death, a woman in Italy, I'm not a big cat fan, so, you know, I'm not mourning the death of a cat, but she did. So she took out a full-page ad in the local newspaper to mourn the death of her beloved cat. Now, her husband, on the other hand, not so much. You know, didn't care about him, but the cat. And lastly, guy after my own heart, a Pastafarian. He sued to make sure that he was able to take his driver's license photo with a strainer on his head. He was able to wear his colander on his head because it is religious apparel. So it is suitable for religious activities because he is a Pastafarian. He belongs to the Church of the Great Flying Spaghetti Monster. So there you go. I want to thank all of our guests, the good representative, Eugene D. Pasquale, thanks to him, Ms. Conti from the NELP, the National Employment Law Project, of course, Bo Haddai. Again, if you want to read his piece, it's over at thericksmithshow.com. Excellent piece on Alec and how he got here, and, of course, Fred McLucky from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, just go to thericksmithshow.com and download it. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
Rick Smith Show starts now.
Let's get right to it. H.R. 6419. I am flipping mad over this. WTF, ma'am. WTF is the only thing I can think of. The emergency unemployment.
I will try to be behind the microphone every night, but this is family that I only see once a year. She's the only sibling I have left. So there may be some time away required. Just family time. So just a little heads up, I'll tweet it or something to let you know one way or the other. But I'll try to be here, and she understands the necessity that I be here. Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful evening. Thanks for all you do to keep all of this going. Thank you for helping out even when I wasn't on the air. Because